Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year after Michael Brown was killed on a street in Ferguson, Missouri, protesters clashed with police officers last Sunday. The week began with GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump feuding with Fox News. Trump's target, anchor Megyn Kelly, found an uneasy ceasefire.
Trump, who is the front runner, will not apologize. And I certainly will not apologize for doing good journalism.
Trouble mounted for the Environmental Protection Agency. It accidentally spilled heavy metal from an abandoned gold mine into Colorado's Animas River, turning it a rusty orange. Residents demanded answers.
Tell us what's in the water. Tell us what's in the water.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Eliana Johnson from the National Review, Jamel Bowie of Slate, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Trump and Jeb's foreign policy speak and Hillary's higher education affordability plan? Or her email servers? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Jamel Bowie. He is staff writer for Slate, where he covers politics, policy, and race. Jamel Bowie, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And from New York, Eliana Johnson joining us, Washington editor at the National Review. Eliana Johnson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. And also from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, Jack Beatty joining us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, John, Jamel, and Eliana.
So this week we had candidates actually talking about real stuff. Talking policy, making proposals, and attacking one another's ideas. We have, starting with Jeb Bush. He's a Republican presidential candidate, obviously, and giving a foreign policy speech at the Reagan Library in California. He went right at Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State and current presidential candidate, for her role, he says, in the rise of ISIS.
ISIS grew while the United States disengaged from the Middle East and ignored the threat. And where was the Secretary of State? Where was Secretary of State Clinton in all of this? Like the president himself, she had opposed the surge, then joined in claiming credit for its success, then stood by as that hard-won victory by American and ally forces was thrown away.
Jack Beatty, what do you hear going on there?
Well, I think he's trying to revise the history of the Iraq War. In his telling, his brother had it won in 2008, then Obama and Clinton lost it by withdrawing the troops in 2011, and ISIS filled the vacuum. It's the GOP stabbed in the back scenario. It overlooks the inconvenient fact that W invaded Iraq. Yesterday in New Hampshire, Jeb said, quote, "I tell you, taking out Saddam turned out to be a pretty good deal. The U.S. invasion upset the balance of power in the Gulf. It brought an Iran-friendly regime to power in Iraq and made Iraq a recruiting ground for jihadis." If that's a pretty good deal, I'd hate to see a pretty bad one. Yesterday, General Ray Ordiano, the retiring chief of staff of the Army, highlighted a second inconvenient fact in the Jeb scenario. Quote, "I remind everybody that us leaving at the end of 2011 was negotiated in 2008 by the Bush administration." Jeb now says the Iraq War was a mistake. That prompts Eugene Robinson to ask, but why would someone who thinks that include Paul Wolfowitz, an architect of the Iraq War, among his advisors?
So you find it pretty audacious on the whole.
It's pretty audacious. You know, Jeb is loyally shouldering his brother's burden of failure.
Eliana Johnson, what was Jeb, what was his alternative? Is he saying, let's put more troops in, let's go back in there?
No, he's not saying this, but I think viewed through a strictly political lens, this marked a major turning point for him because after being on the defensive on Iraq for so long, fielding hostile questions from the media and really handling them poorly, his goal here was to wrest control of the situation. And what he did was offer his own narrative of events that have unfolded in the Middle East. And what he really said was, look, no statesman or president gets everything right. And that was his way of answering the question of should we have invaded or not. He's already said that had he had all the facts at the time, in retrospect, he wouldn't have gone in. But we can't do anything about that now. That the major turning point in the Middle East was the surge. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton opposed that. And what he instead shifted the focus to was the withdrawal of troops from Iraq, a decision that he called a fatal error. And he wants to focus now on ISIS. And he says that that withdrawal of troops created a vacuum that made way for the rise of ISIS. And that is an alternative to the version of history we've heard from President Obama and the Democrats. Voters will ultimately decide which they find more compelling. But on the matter of withdrawing troops from Iraq, I think what hasn't been addressed is George W. Bush did set the date for withdrawal. Mm-hmm. But what Republicans blame the Obama administration for is a failure to negotiate a status of forces agreement. And that's what President Obama was responsible for doing and what he failed to do. That status of forces agreement would have left 10,000 troops on the ground. And President Obama, in a debate with Mitt Romney in 2012, said, no, I didn't want to leave those 10,000 troops there. So he is on the record as having said, ultimately, he just didn't want to really leave troops on the ground in the country. And so that's a debate the president will have ultimately, or Hillary Clinton can take up for him this time around.
Thanks, Ellie. Let Jamelle Bouie take a crack at this also, because I'm just thinking if our memories are rather short term, if we forget that Barack Obama was elected largely on American weariness with deeper involvement in the Middle East, and so I'm wondering how it plays to Jeb Bush's advantage to be blaming the president at this point for disengagement on the Middle East without it sounding like he's saying, well, let's get back in there.
I don't think it plays to his advantage at all, and I have a hard time imagining voters really warming up to the sentiment. I think part of the calculation behind Bush's statement, or Bush's sort of approach to this, is American disgust with the actions of groups like ISIS, with what's happening in Syria, with the sort of most militant rebels in Syria, general distrust of Iran. And I think he's trying to use that to paint President Obama as weak and Hillary Clinton as weak on the question of American national influence in the world and the Middle East in particular. The problem is that the public does see ISIS as a threat. While the public does distrust Iran, the public also does not see the need for further or deeper American intervention in the Middle East. And so that's where Obama and Clinton are sort of on safe ground, that the public is actually weary with these sort of the approach of George W. Bush. And I don't think there's any advantage in Jeb Bush kind of bringing it up or even gesturing towards that kind of approach.
Except, you know, there are two publics. The Republican public is a different, and the Democratic public. According to polls, more than three-quarters of Republicans want U.S. ground troops to fight ISIS in Iraq. Three-quarters of Republicans, and a plurality of them, say that stopping Iran's nuclear program requires, quote, an immediate military strike. There's a hawkish mood in the GOP, and that's what Jeb is speaking to.
On Monday, Hillary Clinton, Democratic presidential candidate, unveiled a $350 million plan to make college more affordable and to reduce student debt.
No student should have to borrow to pay tuition at a public college or university. Schools will have to control their costs and show more accountability to their students. States will have to meet their obligation to invest in higher education.
I said $350 million, if only. Multiply that 1,000. She's talking about a $350 billion plan. Eliana Johnson, your thoughts on this pitch by Hillary Clinton?
Well, one interesting thing, I think, is that it's a less aggressive plan than the one being offered by Bernie Sanders and Governor Martin O'Malley. And instead of their 4 years of free college, she's offering up 2 years of free community college and 4 debt-free years at an in-state public university. And I think what you'll hear, so she'll certainly be challenged from the left on it. I think what you'll hear Republicans say about it is that the solutions for controlling costs, which will be an enormous issue that Republicans talk about, aren't good enough. And that increasing the supply of low-cost college loans, which she will do, and the level of funding from state governments, is sure to backfire. Mm-hmm. And so I think she'll be attacked by Republicans for a failure, saying that this plan simply isn't a good enough way to control costs, which are growing at a rapid rate and making higher education unaffordable for many people.
And Jamelle Bouie, your take on her making this play?
I think it's a very smart play to make. One of the things, so kind of the meta, you know, the meta explanation of intra-Democratic Party politics is that it's very transactional, that the Democratic Party is best described as a group of a disparate group of interest and of you know, policy entrepreneurs and all sorts of groups that want a particular thing from the government. At the same time, Democrats have a sort of broad electoral problem of mobilizing groups of people that may have felt like they didn't get their fair shake from the Obama administration. Debt-free college satisfies both parts of this. On one hand, you have sort of strong, I'll call them just like people lobbying the Democratic Party for debt relief for college students. You have sort of younger activists sort of highlighting this as a major problem. And on the other end, you have younger voters who look at the Democratic Party and who look at the Obama administration and say, what exactly has it done for us? And this is, you know, this is Hillary Clinton saying, look, this is something we will do for you. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not this is a kind of plan that can get through Congress, whether or not there will be spending problems associated with it, that's a different question.
Well, we'll find out.
But politically,
we'll
it's smart.
Yeah, we'll find out on that one in a few years. When we come back from the break, we want to talk a little bit about, does everything that's happening now actually matter to what's going to happen on Election Day? I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're doing our weekly news roundtable. We are talking with Jamelle Bouie. He is staff writer for Slate. Eliana Johnson, Washington editor at the National Review. Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst. And we got through the first 17-20 minutes of the program without mentioning the name Donald Trump in any serious way, but not so fast, because we're going to be listening to Carly Fiorina, Republican presidential candidate, speaking on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, where she explained her frustration with Donald Trump's critiques of moderator and Fox News pundit Megyn Kelly.
Mr. Trump got asked tough questions by a lot of people on Thursday night, but he chose to attack Megyn Kelly. And so on Friday night, I put out in a statement, Mr. Trump, there is no excuse.
Jack Beatty, has this hurt Trump?
Apparently not. He got 20. He's boasting of the 24 million audience that he says his presence won for the debate. But, you know, I think one of the best comments on this whole business was Dan Wasserman in the Boston Globe, really an outstanding political cartoonist. He shows Trump going bleeding, blather, blah, 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 and then a row of elephants standing for the Republican Party. And they're saying, don't look at us. He's the misogynist. One elephant holds a sign saying no exception for rape, incest. Another elephant holding a sign, defund Planned Parenthood. A third elephant holding a sign, no birth control, but he's the misogynist.
Eliana, you were a Fox producer at one point. Am I correct about that?
I was for 3 years.
Okay. So tell us about this, the Fox-Trump relationship. Roger Ailes, the boss at Fox, president at Fox, went to great lengths to sort of smooth things over between Trump and the network. It's been said that in doing so, he did not really back up Megyn Kelly. That's an interpretation. But where does this Fox-Trump relationship stand now?
Well, it's clear Roger Ailes went out of his way to mend fences with Trump. Roger Ailes, as I'm sure many of your listeners know and will remember, once produced a Broadway show. He is keenly understands business, drama, and ratings. And one of the biggest misunderstandings, I think, that exists about Fox News is people think that Fox News exists to boost the Republican Party and put out the GOP's talking points. But the man at the head of Fox News is all about business and ratings. And Donald Trump is great business and great ratings. And that's what I think is at the root of the relationship. I think Megyn Kelly understands that very well. She's worked at Fox for long enough. And I think that's what's at the heart of this.
Jamelle Bouie, I was asking Jack Beatty if Trump is hurt by this development. I want to ask you now about Hillary Clinton and the email server situation. First, take 30 seconds to update our listeners on what happened this week with the emails.
I'll try to take just a sentence. She turned over her email cache to the FBI and to the investigators at the Department of Justice after they found what they said was top secret information that she had emailed from her account.
And it was a rather unexpected move. I mean, she had pushed back against doing just that for months, had she not?
That's right. She has maintained since this was revealed in March that she did not knowingly send classified information through this email account.
So what is the impact on her presidential ambition of this latest move?
So it's funny. There are sort of two different kinds of impact. I think in the short term, this hurts. It hurts because the entire saga emphasizes parts of Hillary Clinton that the public generally does not like. It shows her to be secretive. It shows her to be evasive. It suggests that she's being dishonest. We don't know if she is, but sort of that's the public image around her. And this very much feeds into it. And because it's an ongoing scandal, something that news comes out every couple of weeks and it gets back into the atmosphere and people think about it, it is the kind of thing that can steadily depress her ratings with the public. And that in turn makes her appear to be a weaker general election candidate. And I don't think it's an accident that the murmurs about Joe Biden maybe getting into the race, about Al Gore looking at it. I think those are a reflection of the extent to which there are Democrats who feel very nervous about what all this could mean for Hillary, the general election candidate. Now, with that said, let's say Hillary Clinton, these other people don't get into the race. Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee, which is, you know, generally, I think, the safe bet. Once in a general election, all the things about a general election, the mobilization, the enthusiasm, all these things, I think will cancel out the effect on her favorability of the email scandal. You saw something very similar with Mitt Romney in 2011 and 2012. Mitt Romney was unpopular through 2011. He was unpopular through most of 2012. And then suddenly, Republicans and more independents thought that they liked Mitt Romney, that they thought they were fine with him. Mm-hmm. And that's the process of a campaign taking place. And I expect that to happen to Hillary Clinton. I expect that to happen to whoever is the Republican nominee as well.
It's a perfect segue to where I wanted to take this conversation, which is a little bit of a step back from the deep dive that we've been in for the last 20 minutes and that the cable news channels are doing obsessively, which is this very close coverage of the campaign and a lot of it on the personality aspect and these charges by – these surges by outliers, apparent outliers like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. You know, we're 14 months away, more than 14 months away from Election Day. Jack Beatty, does all of this – will all of this matter come Election Day?
Well, you know, take Jeb Bush. He was tepid in last week's debate, and in some polls his support has eroded. But if political science is predictive, then he's the likely GOP nominee. That's because he's winning the invisible primary, a term abrasive political scientist introduced in an influential book, The Party Decides. Not early polls, not early debates, not even early fundraising. None of these predicts victory so strongly as early endorsements from key players, so they argue, citing campaigns from the 70s to 2004. Hillary Clinton is winning the Democrats' invisible primary, going away. Wikipedia has 7 pages of endorsements for her against 1 page plus for Bernie Sanders. You know, Republican regulars panicked at the thought of the Donald as their standard bearer really should take solace from political science. If the party still decides he won't make it, not with polls suggesting that Clinton and even Sanders would beat him by Goldwater margins, the pros don't pick losers like Donald Trump.
Eliana, your comment on that? Is this all going to matter?
Well, I think the question you're posing is, if we know who the eventual nominees are going to be, if it's going to be Hillary Clinton for the Democrats and Jeb Bush on the right, does how they get there matter? Mm-hmm. If they face serious challenges, does that matter? I think it does, because I think the level of enthusiasm that the Democratic base and the Republican base feel about their candidates really matters. Now, you saw that with President Obama, had a tremendously enthusiastic base, and for the Republicans, you've seen that in the past couple of elections where people were not excited about John McCain. They were not excited about Mitt Romney. And that matters tremendously. It's been a long time since Republicans have had a candidate that the base is excited about, that who they feel like can, A, take the fight to the Democrats, and, B, can communicate with voters. And so even if we know who the nominee is going to be, I think it absolutely matters the extent to which he faces challenges from several upstart candidates, because I think that suggests the level of reservations that the base has about that candidate, which I think suggests the level of skill the candidate has.
An interesting development in terms of what's going to matter in the future is the way in which the Black Lives Matter movement has now intersected with the Democratic campaign, where activists from the movement have twice, including once this week, interrupted rallies by Bernie Sanders and sort of forced a meeting with Hillary Clinton. And in that meeting with Hillary Clinton, that took place on Wednesday, one of the activists, Donesha Yancey, spoke with MSNBC after she met with Clinton in New Hampshire. And she says that the activists associated with Black Lives Matter are going to push all of the presidential candidates to embrace the concept Black Lives Matter.
This is a strategic movement. The Black Lives Matter Network is made up of 25 chapters across the country, and we are absolutely pushing all of the presidential candidates to affirm their stances on this movement and on their commitment to Black lives.
Jamelle Bouie, why Bernie Sanders as a particular target for disruption?
That's a good question. As best I can tell, it is because Bernie Sanders is simultaneously the top challenger to Hillary Clinton. He is drawing massive crowds. He is closest to her in the polls. He is getting the most attention. And he's also extremely accessible. The Black Lives Matter activists tried to disrupt Hillary Clinton's event, and they were promptly stopped by security. By contrast, it appears that you can kind of just waltz up to the stage and Bernie Sanders is there and nothing will happen to you.
But why the Democrats?
I think because this is not – so they simply have more leverage over the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to 2016, Democrats will not win the presidency if they cannot satisfy and mobilize large numbers of African-American voters. At the same time, Democrats – have been, although they've spoken a lot on inequality and those things have a racial dimension, there's been less talk about this perceived problem of police violence and criminal justice reform. And so I think that Black Lives Matter activists are making a strategic choice to target the most visible Democrat, who is also the most accessible, in hopes that he begins to talk about these issues as well and acts pressure on other candidates, and specifically Hillary Clinton, to do the same. Because Clinton is very aware of what happened in 2008 and will do everything she can to preempt that from happening again.
Jack Beatty, do you think the movement is actually making progress with Sanders and Clinton?
Well, it seems they're certainly getting a hearing. Sanders has hired an African-American press secretary. He's come out with a program addressing the issue, or at least he's going to come up with a program addressing the issue of police violence, police excess. But, Vermont, just 2 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, The NAACP is 100 years old. Vermont, just a month ago, opened its first chapter. This is white world up here. And this isn't an idiom. This isn't a kind of politics he's all that familiar with. And he's finding his feet. And he's got a long way to go to compete with Clinton, of whom, you know, more than 80% of blacks approve of her. And that really is one of the big limiting factors in his campaign. But, you know, also what happened in Seattle, it's hard for any liberal person to approve quite what happened. Political speech was shut down. That's not a good thing. You know, political speech should be able to proceed in real time. You say your thing, I say my thing, and the public chooses. When you shut down speech, as those protesters did, you're essentially limiting one of the basic rights, and the one thing that makes us distinctive in politics, that we can speak our mind and we can listen. So that's a dangerous trend, I think.
Let's bring in Laura from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, John. I kind of had everything all planned of what I was going to say, but after that last comment, I have to say I'm a white woman who lives in Des Moines, Iowa. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and I grew up in a black neighborhood. So my perspective is a little different than some white people. And I guess I would like to just say, dear white people, it is so systemic in the black community of what they have to deal with when they leave their community every day. I want white people to really just sit back, take a deep breath, and just talk to somebody who's having to deal with that every day. And as far as what the last comment was, I understand about free speech, and I get the point about shutting down Bernie when he's at a planned event, but that is exactly what needs to happen. Hmm. We need to have the insular of the Democratic Party be opened. And I think that these black activists want a place at the table, and they're not finding it as easy as they thought it would be with our Democratic nominees, or so-called, you know, future Democratic nominees. So I think it's good that he's kind of, you know, he probably had to stop and, you know, hire a black secretary and press secretary. And, you know, Hillary Clinton's doing her thing. She's riding in the coattails of her husband. He's very popular in the black community. She's got some work to do as well. I personally really like O'Malley. He has come to Des Moines several times, and I've got to hear him speak and look at the whites of his eyes. I like what he has to say, so I'd like for you guys to talk about him. He doesn't get
all right
to play.
Good point.
Might be kind of good for him, you know.
Good point, Laura. I'm gonna break in because I do like that point, and I do want to come back to O'Malley, but I also want to use your point to transition to the fact that we're also going to be talking about Ferguson. The slogan comes out of a year ago in Ferguson. This week marked the anniversary of Michael Brown's death. And what do we have now in his hometown? We have another state of emergency. One protester or activist came to the town. His name is Tay Johnson. He came and saying he was angered that St. Louis County authorities were calling for a state of emergency in response to the protests and some violence.
The state of emergency is this genocide. That's the state of emergency, not a few people on the streets. Okay. This is the state of emergency right here, this genocide. And that's what they need to be calling a state of emergency on.
Jamel Bowie, what's happening there?
There were protests, and the protests during some of the protests or adjacent to the protests, there was gunfire. There were people attempting to break into stores, and this prompted a very sudden police crackdown.
Were you surprised? Go ahead.
Sorry,
you go ahead.
No, I think prior to this, the police department, the St. Louis County Police Department, not necessarily the Ferguson one, that was patrolling the protest, was kind of outfitted in the gear that it had used the previous year, which I think agitated people. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of research to suggest that when police approach or address protesters like this, it does kind of put tension into the air where it didn't exist previously. And the combination of all of this, I think, just resulted in a scene that looked very similar to the one we saw last year.
Eliana Johnson, your response to it and what this current state of emergency does to the long-term conversation that people hoped would come out of last year.
A couple of things. It really demonstrates that this issue is not receding from national consciousness.
Right.
There have been similar incidents, not only in Ferguson, but across the country. And I think in part, the continuing unrest is fueled by the fact that no policy changes have really taken place. And I think that is also fueling the Black Lives Matter movement. So this persistent belief that African Americans are being abused and mistreated by the police is also fueled by the fact that the problem is not being addressed.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out, risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint and you can save $50. That's casper.com/onpoint. Now back to the show.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. And in other news this week, dozens dead in a huge explosion in Tianjin, China, at an industrial waterfront.
A first blast had shaken the port city of Tianjin just before midnight. Then this. A massive explosion, many times bigger than the first blast.
And Colorado theater shooter James Holmes received life in prison for killing 12 and injuring 70 in his 2012 attack. Dave Hoover, who lost his nephew, A.J. Boyk, said he was disappointed.
My verdict would have been death, because he has no value left in this world. He gets to hug his mom and dad. He gets to correspond. We don't get that. We've lost that. But that's the system.
And football legend Frank Gifford died. He played for the New York Giants, and he went on to call Monday Night Football for years. In 2008, Frank Gifford said that he had two good careers.
I started out playing the game. My highlights were in black and white. I finished up, you know, pretty good. We won a championship. Played for a guy named Vince Lombardi, who was special in my life. And then I went to work for ABC. When I put it all together, I guess I did all right.
You can join our conversation. What's your top story of the week? Tell us your thoughts on the EPA and the toxic Orange River, China's currency, Jimmy Carter. We're talking with Jamelle Bouie, staff writer for Slate, Eliana Johnson, Washington editor at the National Review, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. And we've had some history made today. The U.S. Flag is flying again at the embassy in Havana, Cuba. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, quote, people of Cuba would be best served by a genuine democracy. Let's bring in some callers to this conversation. Let's bring in Carl from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome to On Point.
Hi. You know, this Sunday, as I'm watching the Sunday show, I listened in just disgust, especially as a husband and a father of three daughters, as the Republican Party just cavalierly debated a woman's time of the month. And it just boggled my mind how this is getting so much airtime. And, you know, this morning, seeing the flag go back and seeing real news, real history being made, and it has went so underreported during the week, as the clown show of the Republican Party is just gobbling up all the airtime, to see President Obama put forth, history, his legacy, and finally doing away with one of the more dumber foreign policies of the United States over the past 50, 55 years.
So, Carl, you're saying you feel that the conversation has been trivial lately when something as significant as Cuba is happening?
Absolutely very trivial. I mean, this is something very significant as far as our foreign policy history. A wrong is starting to be righted.
Let me break in, Carl, let's take it in the direction you're suggesting. We just talked about the fact that the flag went up today. Jack Beatty, you know, some people on the planet were alive when the flag came down. How big a deal is it to you?
Well, apparently, two of the people who helped take the flag down were American Marines who helped put it up, were American Marines who in 1961 helped take it down. And I'm also reading that John Kerry had Ted Kennedy's cane with him. He was leaning on that. Ted Kennedy, for years, was a critic of this, as Carr rightly says, pointless, futile policy toward Cuba. And you know, Hillary Clinton wants to go Barack Obama one better. She's talking about trying to repeal the trade embargo on Cuba. That would require congressional action, but it shows the scale of history we're dealing with. Big change.
On Wednesday, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Gina McCarthy, traveled to Colorado, and she pledged to clean up the spill that began on August 5th.
No agency could be more upset about the incident happening, or more dedicated in terms of doing our job and getting this right.
Eliana Johnson, are there more implications to this other than simply noting that the EPA really blew it on this one?
Well, I think there will be continuing policy implications, and at the very least political implications, in that you're going to hear Republicans all across the country calling attention to this now and in the future and saying that with the president who has just unveiled sweeping new energy regulations, this is not the time to be giving the EPA more authority and more power when it has just demonstrated that it can't reliably control the lands that are under its authority right now. I think that's the message you'll be hearing from Republicans.
Let's bring in Rob from Detroit, Michigan. Rob, welcome to On Point.
John, how are you today?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling, as not only a former police officer, but as a black man as well. And I think if some of the folks, when they're talking about Black Lives Count, really need to have a better representation than Michael Brown. The man tried to rob a store, he assaulted somebody, and then he went for the police officer's gun. And in my experience, I don't care if your skin is white, black, or green. You try to get my gun, you're trying to kill me, and I'm going to kill you. That's just the way it is in that particular situation. I was a police officer for 25 years. I had a partner for 11 years who was a white man, and you couldn't ask to meet a nicer gentleman. But there were several situations where we wanted some people who had an altercation to disperse, and he would have to stay in the car and let me handle the situation alone because we knew if he walked out there, the black people would be throwing bottles and rocks at him just because of the color of his skin. And this thing works both ways. You want respect? There are white police officers who do abuse black people. And I've seen it, but I've also seen black citizens who have a complete disrespect for the police officers, in particular the white ones. And when that situation happens, we don't hear much about that with the media. We only hear the situations when the white police officer is abusive to the black citizen.
Rob, thanks for your call on that, because I want to bring into the conversation the case that took place a week ago today. There was an incident in Arlington, Texas, in which a white officer shot and killed a 19-year-old black man who had broken into some sort of car dealership. And on Tuesday this week, his boss, Police Chief Will Johnson, fired him. He announced that the officer who shot and killed Christian Taylor was out of a job.
This is an extremely difficult and tragic case. Our community is hurting. Our family is hurting. Our department is certainly hurting. And quite frankly, our nation is hurting.
Jamelle Bouie, do you think that firing would have happened pre-Ferguson?
I don't know enough about that particular police department to conclusively say that it wouldn't have. But I do think it would be crazy to say that police chiefs across the country are not cognizant of the kind of media attention that comes with these things now. And so my hunch is that, yeah, he probably this officer who shot Christian Taylor is probably out of a job because of the events of the past year. I want to say real quickly about the question of Michael Brown as, I guess, the appropriate symbol. Mm-hmm. I think what's important to understand, and I've heard that critique, and I do not discount it whatsoever. I think what's important to understand is that in the moment of August 9th and August 10th and August 11th, 2014, we did not have any of that additional information. We did not know that Michael Brown had stolen from a convenience store earlier. We did not know the details of his altercation with Officer Darren Wilson, which the Department of Justice report suggests that both men played a part in the escalation of that altercation. All we saw, all the people of Ferguson saw, was a teenage boy who was lying dead in the street for 4 hours with no one to attend to his body. Mm. And I think that sort of duration of time during which his body was prostrate in the street is the galvanizing incident. The shooting, obviously, too, but I think that had that been dealt with immediately, you wouldn't have seen the kind of reaction you saw. But the sense that his body was just being ignored is, I think, right. What sparked real and genuine anger.
Great. That's a very useful perspective to put on what happened last year. Let's bring in Margaret from Nashville. Margaret, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I was originally calling about the Oath Keepers, but after just hearing those comments, especially from the police officer, it really resonates with me because he really feels like that people feel like that it's excusable to kill people over 99 cents. And we don't know what happened in that altercation with Zarin Wilson. We only know what was said, and we have no real eyewitnesses to what happened. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a little ridiculous that these people are being murdered. Like, you see black people, especially people of color, that we have to, like, err and be, like, with the most caution. Like, we can't do anything. Like, you know, 99 cents is what that little boy's life was worth. And everybody wants to refer to him as a man and...
But Margaret, what were you going to say about the Oath Keepers?
Similar thing is, in these situations, these people are rioting, or I wouldn't say rioting, protesting over their lives. Like, in the black community, this isn't a outlier. This is an everyday occurrence for us. And these Oath Keepers come in, and they get to carry their open weapons and walk around and proceed and be the militia, but we can't even speak out without being put in a state of emergency, and that is ridiculous.
All right, Margaret, thank you for that. I want to explore this Oath Keepers question you raised just a little bit with our guests. On Wednesday, NPR spoke to a gentleman named John Karaman. He's one of this group called the Oath Keepers who showed up in Ferguson this week. They are a group of independent armed men who are wearing camouflage, and they're patrolling Ferguson.
We're not a threat to anybody other than those that would seek to usurp our Constitution and not afford people their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. We get up and put our pants on like everybody else. You know, the only difference is, you know, we run towards danger instead of running from it. We're the sheepdogs that keep the rest of the flock safe.
Do any of you know who this group is and what they represent? Jack Beatty, any idea?
I haven't a clue.
Eliana?
Only what I've read about them in the newspaper, but I think it's a real sign of, in the African-American community, we've seen a real decline of trust in institutions. And I think now in the white community, you're seeing the same sort of decline of trust and feeling of the need to put together of their own sort of militia type of military or police force. And we've seen the same thing. I remember about 10 years ago, the Minutemen were doing the same thing, patrolling the border, a sort of citizen type force. But obviously never a good sign when you see these sorts of law enforcement initiatives taken up by regular people.
Let's bring
hey, John, yeah. John, may I just make
sure.
One point to address Rob, our policeman. You know, in March, Jonathan Capehart, African-American intellectual writer for The Washington Post, wrote a very important column. The headline says everything. Hands Up, Don't Shoot was built on a lie. And he went back and read the Justice Department reports on the killing of Michael Brown, and he said, "They have forced me to deal with two uncomfortable truths. Brown never surrendered with his hands up, and Wilson was justified in shooting Brown." Now, I'm not saying I believe that. I'm saying he did, and that's what he says the Justice Department reports bear out.
Let's bring in Kevin from Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thank you. I'd like to talk about Jimmy Carter for a moment. Mm-hmm. The 70s were a hellish decade economically. Double-digit inflation, wage and price controls, energy embargoes. It was a terrible, terrible decade. And I think Jimmy Carter gets a raw deal when people assess his presidency because he didn't come in and in 4 years correct 7 years of catastrophe. And I've always believed that he did the best he could, and I don't think anybody could have done better with that particular decade.
And Kevin, for those who don't know, I want to point out the reason you're bringing up Jimmy Carter. It's at the age of 90. He's announced that he has cancer of rather serious kinds. The indication is that that he may not have long. It's unclear. I'm not saying that for sure because he's not being clear about it. But the message seems to be the prognosis seems not to be good. Eliana Johnson, your thoughts on Jimmy Carter's his legacy at this point as opposed to what it was when he left office?
You know, I think he will have something of a polarized legacy, at least among Republicans who resent what they consider to be his meddling in the diplomatic process. But overall, best wishes to his family, and I think overall he'll be remembered as a good man and somebody who did his best while in office.
And of course, that meddling in the diplomatic process produced the only substantive diplomatic achievement in the Middle East in my lifetime, the Camp David Agreement, and between Sadat and Begin. And all that represented. And, you know, there's a recent book by Lawrence Wright that makes clear the heroic efforts President Carter exerted to bring these two, Sadat and Begin, together and to bring this miracle off. It holds today. Israel is much safer today without having to worry about fighting Egypt again. And that achievement, almost all of it. I mean, the principals deserve credit. Sadat had to move. Begin had to move. Jimmy Carter made the move.
Sesame Street has three favorite new letters, and they are H, B, and O. The nonprofit Sesame Street has a 5-year deal with the HBO Premium Cable Network.
Hit me! That's H! A soul H!
It's made some people sad because it basically means that people are going to have to pay to see the first run of Sesame Street after decades. That represents a change that some people are not particularly happy with, but it's the way they're going to stay in business. And before we go out, Jack Beat, I want to come back to you very, very quickly. You're living in New Hampshire, side of the primary. It's now legal to take a selfie in the ballot box. Is that correct?
I'm going to send mine. I'm going to put it on the. I'll tweet it. You'll see me there.
So it was against the law, and the law has been overturned. So we'll be looking forward to that photograph from you.
We're ahead of the zeitgeist up here in New Hampshire.
All right. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Jamelle Bouie, staff writer for Slate. Thank you so much for being on Point.
Thank you for having me.
And Eliana Johnson, Washington editor at the National Review. Thank you as well.
Thanks, John.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, as always. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
You can join the conversation and continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, thousands of acres are ablaze in the West, and there could be more wildfires to come. Is it time to change the way we fight these fires? I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.